Well, it's great to welcome you back once again. We are continuing our studies of the book of Romans, and we're coming at this point to the second half of Romans chapter 2. And I'll just remind you of our basic lay of the land here with respect to the organization of Romans. We've said that Romans is essentially divided into two major segments, which I like to call on the one hand bad news and then good news. And the point where we shift from bad to good news is in Romans chapter 3, beginning at verse 21. Right now, we're about halfway through this bad news section. The main thing Paul is trying to accomplish here is to show that regardless of whether a person is Jewish or Gentile, that person is equally exposed to the wrath of God. It was, of course, a common thought in the first century among many people, especially in the Jewish world, to think that because of their special status as the chosen people, they had some kind of exemption from the judgments that might otherwise befall the rest of the human race. They thought that by virtue of having been born into a Jewish community, of a Jewish family, that they had an intact family tree that they could trace back to Abraham himself, that they had kept the requirements of the law, especially circumcision, observing days, and so on. All of that sort of created the impression in the mind of many that that more to put them in a kind of inner track, a sort of special status. And of course, what Paul wants to do is simply drop a bomb on that entire idea and show that whether a person is Gentile or Jew, either one, that person is fully exposed to the wrath of God, guilty before God's holy tribunal, and that therefore everybody is equally in need of the grace that comes through the gospel. Well, we've seen Paul argue pretty effectively with respect to the Gentile world that particular thesis. He's shown that that which can be known about God is evident to them. God's made it plain to them. From the creation of the world, it's obvious. They don't have any excuse. They prove the information got through because they're constantly engaging in judgments with respect to other people. And when you judge somebody else with respect to a standard, you prove incontestably that you know that standard. Paul has talked about, therefore, the standard is known, the standard is just, and the standard will be applied without partiality. And all of that was part of our discussion last time, and that really wrapped up the discussion of how this idea is applied to the Gentile world. But now Paul is going to shift his focus and look more at those who are in the Jewish community. Interestingly, he's going to use something of the same logic, the same organizational approach with respect to those who are Jewish as he used with respect to those who are Gentile. And we'll see that right away. Again, we're going to be putting in at verse 17 of chapter 2, but the entire discussion goes all the way over deep into chapter 3. So we're only going to be talking about really the first part of this journey, but let's take a look at it. We're at chapter 2, verse 17, and I want to start in at verse 17 then and read down to verse 24. This is the Word of God. But if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in your relationship to God and know His will and determine what is best because you are instructed in the law, and if you are sure that you are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then that teach others, will you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You forbid adultery, but do you commit adultery? You that abhor idols, do you rob temples? You that boast in the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Well, that's our opening paragraph. Let's just have a word of prayer and we'll take a look at what Paul is saying here. God of the ages, we are grateful to you for the opportunity once again to turn our attention to these remarkable words that come from the Apostle Paul. And we pray that our reflection upon them would be guided richly through your Spirit, and that you would help us to understand both with mind and heart those things that you have for us. And we ask this in the name of Christ. Amen. So we start off here and notice immediately that Paul has now shifted his focus and is particularly interested in those who call themselves Jews. They might have been thinking that all of the things Paul was saying with respect to the Gentiles was great. They're very much endorsing it. They think those evil Gentiles out there deserve to have that kind of diatribe against them. But now Paul wants to turn the focus a little bit. Now he wants to say, you who thought you were in such a nice position with respect to this assault, this indictment that I've been developing, I want you to ask yourself some hard questions. If you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in your relation to God, knowing His will, knowing what is best, instructed out of the law, confident that you're a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, corrector of the foolish, and so on. You see, Paul is starting here with them in the very same place that he started with the Gentiles. Remember my three R's. We had revelation, rebellion, and retribution. Well, at this point, we're talking about revelation. But notice now that the revelation that Paul has in mind is not general revelation, such as we saw with respect to the Gentiles. The heavens declare the glory of God. The earth displays His handiwork. That's the revelation that God gives to all people. And while that revelation is not sufficient to bring about salvation, it is sufficient to establish guilt. It is sufficient to render a person exposed to the wrath of God and guilty before Him. That general revelation, of course, is the main thing that Paul is emphasizing in chapter 1 and 2. But now, when we come to a discussion of those who are Jewish, the focus shifts from general to special revelation. Special revelation is more particular, precise, and detailed information about God and given to a smaller community. That is to say, not everybody has special revelation, but those that do have a much deeper insight into the character of God, into the ways of God, and particularly into the redemptive activity of God in history. Well, here, of course, the focus is on the Jewish people who have the law, and that's just another word for special revelation. And they are proud of it. This isn't something Paul has to prove. He doesn't have to make a philosophical argument such as he did with the Gentiles, showing that they know the law because they use it to judge others. That kind of argumentation, of course, was essential when Paul was going to make his case with respect to the Gentiles. But hey, at this point, with the Jewish people, he doesn't have to prove it because they boast in it. The very thing he's trying to demonstrate is the very thing that they would be the first to admit and indeed to enthusiastically support and so what at this point Paul is simply reminding them of the attitude that they have. They are confident that they are a guide to the blind, a light to those in darkness, correcting the foolish, teaching children, having the very essence of the knowledge of the truth of the law, and all of that, of course, would be that which they would fully agree with and affirm. But now Paul, of course, shifts the focus a little bit, turns the tables, and asks them the hard questions. You then, verse 21, who teach others, do you not teach yourself? There's an old expression you've probably heard about people not practicing what they preach. And this is essentially the point that Paul is making here. You teach others. You hold yourself out as having this peculiar expertise, and you're so very happy to help others, to explain to them the error of their ways. And yet, are you prepared to take that same examination that you're so happy to dish out and apply it to yourself? You that teach others, will you not teach yourself? You preach against stealing. Do you steal? Now, any thoughtful Jewish person understood the wider ramifications of the law. They understood that stealing was not simply a matter of procuring somebody else's property, but it could go to a much more subtle level. They had the Ten Commandments. They knew that the last commandment of the Ten Commandments was thou shalt not covet. They understood that that was a law that goes to the inner motives. It's not simply a behavioral standard, it's a motivational standard. And they knew, of course, that that was the way that the law was to be construed and understood. And so this was not news to them. This was not some kind of new kind of insight that they'd never thought of before. Indeed, even when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount radicalizes the law, when he says things like, you've heard, you should not commit adultery, but I say to you, if you look with lust, you've committed adultery in your heart. Well, this wasn't new to them. Jesus was not saying something that was unprecedented. Their own tradition, their own teaching throughout the Jewish history had made it quite clear that that was the implication of the law. And so at this point, Paul is simply remarking the obvious to them. He's simply pointing out something that they should readily acknowledge. You say, don't steal, but you, of course, understand that even coveting, even desiring that which is not legitimately mine, nor could it legitimately be mine, represents a more subtle expression of the same crime. And therefore, you are still guilty under this law in which you are boasting. You don't have any exemption. You don't have any back door at this point. You have the same kind of problem on your hands because you also are not living up to what you know. In the last discussion, we talked about people who judged. They knew a standard, imposed it on others, and yet would have to acknowledge that they were not themselves living by that standard. The Jewish person even more would have to face that precisely the same problem in their own ethical system. You teach then others, don't you teach yourself? Don't steal. You forbid adultery, do you commit adultery? You that abhor idols, do you rob temples? This is a subtle and somewhat strange point that Paul is making here. The best opinion seems to be that there was, of course, in the ancient world, a widespread understanding that Jewish people would abhor idols. They would not be involved in worshiping idols. They were, of all the ancient population, those who were the most rigorously committed to a monotheistic outlook. And yet it was well known that there were many Jewish people around the ancient world who nevertheless were willing to sort of make a profit off of enterprises that did contribute to the idolatrous practices that were afoot. And so at least in some kind of broad sense, they were themselves robbing temples, even though they were not involved in idolatry, and that in itself would represent a kind of compromise of that particular standard in their own ethical outlook. You that boast in the law, he asked the rhetorical question, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? It was a commonplace. It was, in fact, a given, and they understood it, that the name of God was blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And so Paul is making this rather powerful point that these who are Jewish people, even though they have the law, are not exempted from exposure to the wrath of God because of that. That even though they are in that preferential position, that may in fact actually make them worse off, in a sense, because they have this law but are failing to live up to it. Now, it may very well be, as Paul is making this argument, that he would have Jewish people concurring in it. It may very well be that they would actually agree that the point that Paul is driving at is something that's true, but they might make the kind of end run, the sort of excuse in the face of this, well, yeah, but Paul, we are circumcised. As if to say the state of being circumcised becomes a kind of excuse by which a person could exempt himself or herself from actually doing what the law requires, a kind of free pass, in other words, a license to get out from under what might otherwise be the requirements of the law. And that seems to be the point that Paul's raising now when we come to verse 25. Let's listen to these verses beginning there down to the end of this chapter. Paul raises this question sort of anticipating that that would be the question that they might bring up at this. He says, circumcision indeed is of value if you obey the law. But if you break the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. So, if those who are uncircumcised keep the requirements of the law, will not their uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? Then those who are physically uncircumcised but keep the law will condemn you that have the written code and circumcision but break the law. For a person is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is true circumcision outward, external, and physical. Rather, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly. And real circumcision is a matter of the heart. It is spiritual and not literal. Such a person receives praise not from others, but from God. Now that's a powerful text, and it would be a highly controversial and explosive text in the minds and hearts of the people who would have originally heard it. But let's look first of all at verse 25, where Paul says circumcision has value if you obey the law. Now you see, the argument that these folks may have made was that the fact that I have circumcision excuses me from keeping the law. Sure, Paul, I'm not practicing what I preach. Sure, Paul, I'll grant that even though the law says don't steal, I engage in covetousness, I may cut corners here and there, but I'm circumcised. And so therefore, I have a kind of special exemption from the requirements that you're laying out. It reminds me of years and years ago when I was I was probably 10 or 11 years old. I was a youth and I had a friend, and I happened to attend a church that was Baptist in its tradition. It didn't baptize infants. And my friend was a Lutheran, and he went to a church that did baptize infants. We were having a conversation one day about baptism, and I was noting in my conversation with him that he was pretty indifferent about living a Christian life. He didn't go to church very much. He certainly, to my knowledge, didn't read the Bible. He tended to use fairly bad language and so on. And I was just having a conversation with him, as a 10-year-old, inquiring about this. And he readily granted that he wasn't doing very much to pursue a life of sincere devotion to Christ or obedience to Him. But he said, I don't worry too much about it because, and this is what he said, at least I'm baptized. At least I'm baptized. As if the fact that he had been baptized, as an infant in this case, sort of gave him a special excuse to not be involved in otherwise living the life of obedience to Christ that you would normally think would be incumbent upon a person who called himself or herself a Christian. At least I'm baptized. Well, I can imagine this first century Jewish person making a statement like that. Well, at least I'm circumcised, I may not do all of these things, Paul, as you have correctly noted, but at least I have this sacramental status, and on the basis of that, I have some idea that I am in better condition than somebody else might be. Paul doesn't have much patience with this. He thinks that for a person to use circumcision as an excuse, a kind of license to avoid obedience to the law, is in fact an insult to circumcision and represents a huge, gross misapprehension of the real significance of that rite. I think that Paul might liken circumcision to something like a person wearing a wedding ring. I'm married, I have a wedding ring on, I hope you can kind of see it there. And this wedding ring stands for and symbolizes the fact that I'm married. Now the wedding ring in that sense symbolizes a relationship in which I have this special person in my life, and we are united together, we live together, we enjoy each other's company, and so on. It also represents a certain obligation. When I took wedding vows many years ago, I promised to live a certain way. I took upon myself a law which would restrain me from engaging in behaviors that might otherwise have been all right before I married. I restricted myself to keep to this one person, so I'm no longer free to go out socially with other women and kind of engage in that sort of activity because I'm married. And now I have put myself within a kind of obligation there. What would you think if I came along and said, well, yeah, I'm married. You can see I've got this wedding ring right here. It proves it. And the fact that I'm married gives me freedom, therefore, to live in complete disregard to this relationship. I, you know, stay out. I go out with other people. I engage in activities that are really consistent with my married state. You would think that there was something wrong with me. And you would really think there's something wrong with me if I said, but at least I've got this wedding ring. So even though I'm not living very faithfully to my marriage vows, at least I've got this ring on, and that kind of excuses my misbehavior. Well, you would think not only does it not excuse my misbehavior, but it actually makes it all the worse, you know, that I've sort of added insult to injury here, using my wedding ring to excuse my indifference to the fundamental obligations of my married relationship. Can you imagine that Paul might say something like this, if we were to use the idea of a wedding ring rather than circumcision, it might drive the point home a little bit. He says in verse 25, and you can imagine it saying that something like this, a wedding ring is indeed of value if you keep your marriage vows. But if you break your marriage vows, your wedding ring has become as if you didn't have a wedding ring. And if those who don't have a wedding ring keep their marriage vows, won't that be regarded as if they did have a wedding ring? And those who don't have the ring but keep their vows might rise up and judge you, who, though you have a wedding ring, are disregarding your marriage vows. That's really the idea. Circumcision stood for an inner disposition of heart. It stood for the idea that my life is going to be oriented and directed toward keeping God's law, being faithful to the obligations that are incumbent upon me as one who is a member of this community of faith. The circumcision that I have in my body is intended to stand for this greater commitment of my heart. It was, of course, a common problem in the Old Testament that people might have the physical rite of circumcision, but disregard their obligations to obey God. And even in the Old Testament, you'll therefore hear of the idea, for example, in the prophecy of Isaiah and elsewhere, of people who are uncircumcised in heart. Oh, they may have the external rite, they may have this sacramental status, but when it comes to the actual state of their heart, they have disregarded the obligations. They're circumcised in body, but not in heart. And that, of course, is already part of the Jewish understanding from the Old Testament prophets. Paul is not saying anything here that they didn't already understand. And so if a Jewish person were to come and to try to excuse an indifferent attitude toward keeping the law based on this sacramental status, then that, of course, would be the problem that they would face under the critique of the Apostle Paul. He reaches now this rather dramatic conclusion in these last two verses. And this certainly would be the most controversial thing Paul has said so far in the book of Romans. And it would be something that as a Jewish person would read it, they could be highly offended in hearing Paul say such a thing as this. But remember, the fundamental thesis of the entire book of Romans is this question, who are the people of God? Who are the seed of Abraham? Who are the people who are the true Israel? Who are the true descendants and recipients and beneficiaries of the promises that were made to Abraham and his seed? Who are those people? Who are they? And in the first century, it was very common to assume the Jewish people were those people. But the message of the gospel was intended to redefine the question, the answer to that question, who are the true people of God? And this is the first of several times in the book of Romans when Paul is going to hammer this point home with a great deal of force. And notice how dramatically he puts it. We're in verse 28. For a person is not a Jew, not a Jew, who is one outwardly, nor is true circumcision external and physical. If you're born a Jew, you're born into a Jewish family, you can trace your family tree right back to Abraham himself, You know the tribe that you're in. You were circumcised the eighth day. You keep the law. You observe the dietary regulations. You do all the things that are incumbent upon a person. Paul says, you are not a Jew. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Those are fighting words. That's the kind of thing that got Paul in a whole lot of trouble in the first century. When he began to talk like that, people who were proud of their Jewish status began to take offense, and they began to take offense in a big way. And that's part of the reason that Paul himself was so controversial. It's part of the reason that when he eventually wound up in Jerusalem, as we were saying in two or three sessions ago, he was put in the crosshairs of the hostility of that city and arrested and held in prison for a couple of years. All of that was because he was saying things like this. He was saying that the true Jew is not one who's simply born in that status, but as he continues in verse 29, rather a person is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is of the heart. And again, as I was saying, this is nothing new. The Old Testament repeatedly drives home that point that there is a heart that is to accompany these commitments. Isaiah, of course, makes that very famous remark, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. The book of Romans stands, among many things, for the idea that the true worship of God is not simply a matter of doing certain things, engaging in certain rituals, engaging in certain activity. These things may be important. And Paul, in fact, does not reject any of these. But the point he's driving at is if those things are all that are going on in the life of religious activity, then it is all for naught. That person is lost. That person does not have the benefits of God's redemptive provision because they have bypassed the one thing that really matters. When we get to chapter 10 in Romans, we're going to hear Paul say of the Jewish people, they have a zeal for God. They're zealous. They're full of activity. They're full of all kinds of industry. But Paul says that zeal is not informed by knowledge. It's an ignorant zeal. Religion can be a matter of great activity. It can be a matter of great industry. There can be an awful lot of things going on. But if that activity is not accompanied by a true heart of faith, then it is all for naught. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 that if I speak with the tongue of men and angels and have not love, then it is nothing. I can surrender my body to the flames. I can be a martyr for some kind of religious cause. And yet if there's not love, then it's lost. And of course, for Paul, there in 1 Corinthians 13 and in many other places, the only true and genuine love is that love that flows from a heart of faith. And so the point is that whatsoever is not of faith, as Paul says later in Romans, is sin. Whatsoever is not of faith is lost. It's going to be wood, hay, and stubble. It's going to go up in smoke. It's going to be lost in the flames. There is nothing of value in it unless it is accompanied by faith. Well, when Paul made that kind of argument, of course, in the first century, it created quite a buzz, and there was a fair amount of hostility and controversy that was connected to the apostles' message by virtue of having said that. So, we've begun our examination of Paul and his analysis now of the Jewish state of mind. We've noticed that they have revelation. They indeed boast in it, but they are also equally faulty in not keeping the law that they have. There's no excuse for them with respect to circumcision. When we get into chapter 3, we're going to see him therefore reaching a similar conclusion. Revelation, rebellion, retribution. These people have revelation, but they've rebelled against it. There's no escape from it with respect to circumcision, and now there is retribution. And that becomes the basic content of the first few verses of chapter 3. And really the rest of chapter 3 is going to then reach this dramatic conclusion in which Paul says at chapter 3, verse 10, there is none righteous, no, not one. Both Jew and Gentile, Paul says, we've proven all of them are under the weight of sin, and all of them, therefore, fall vastly short of the glory of God, the mark and standard that He has established for us. So that's where we're going to go on our next occasion together. Again, it's been a real delight to be here with you. I hope these are useful studies that we're doing, and we're just underway now, and we'll be plowing along at about this pace throughout the rest of this series on the Book of Romans. So until next time, God richly bless you.